Thank you, Bianca, for these nice remarks and also for the invitation. So as you already said, I will give a general introduction to spin foams and covariant methods in loop quantum gravity. And I will cover a large area of different ideas and concepts such that you get a bit familiar with many different subjects. So the title of the conference is Renormalization in Background Invariant Theories. So first of all, I will say a bit just as an introduction and motivation what we actually mean by background invariance and what we mean by renormalization. So this is probably all very familiar to all of you, but still it's maybe interesting to remember. So what do we mean by background invariance? Well, a theory is defined by an action which is functional of a certain number of fields. And we say a theory is background invariant if it is diffeomorphism invariant. So this action is typically an integral over a manifold, and it is background independent if it is invariant, if the action is invariant under diffeomorphisms. So diffeomorphisms are maps which are invertible and see infinitely times differentiable of the manifold onto itself. And it maps any point to some other point on the manifold. And given this map, we can also map any tensor field around the manifold. In particular, if you have a metric, for instance, we can compute the pullback. And then we can ask what are diff invariant theories. And the simplest diffeomorphism invariant theories, the simplest background invariant theories are those that are just topological theories. So a prototypical example is just the BF action that is the curvature 2 form of a certain Lie algebra valued connection integrated against a B field. If M is a d-dimensional manifold, B is a d-2 form. And in three dimensions, what is important about this action, in three dimensions, this is already an action for gravity. Another action with transignments, which is again an action for gravity in three dimensions in the presence of a cosmological constant. These are, however, just toy models, and what is important for us is general relativity, which is also background independent because we can because the entire action is, of course, invariant under these coordinate transformations or diffeomorphisms. So what is the meaning? So why do we, as written as here, this is just an abstract mathematical definition, but what is the physical meaning, the physical motivation why we want to have background independence? The point is that by introducing a metric and by making it dynamical, as was envisioned by Einstein, space-time itself, the points of the manifold completely lose their physical existence. So they don't have any physical meaning on their own. What matters are only the fields that exist on the manifold modulo diffeomorphisms. So how the fields are live literally on themselves. What does this realize? Well, how Einstein found this, of course, was by realizing that a theory should be the same for under general coordinate transformations. So, as having said this, we now come to the second part, namely renormalization. And here, a prototypical example is lattice QCD, which shares key properties of loop quantum gravity. The theory is defined by a lattice action, which is given by the Euclidean QCD action put onto a lattice. And what is this action? Well, it's just a trace of the holonomy around a plaquette in a hypercubic lattice. Now, the path integral over all connections is represented by an integral over all link holonomies with respect to the Hamm measure on the group. The observables of the theory are Wilson loops around the boundary of the elementary plaquettes. And what we generally find in such a theory is, I mean, this is easy to read off from these properties, is that the Wilson loop observable around a closed loop will scale with the area of this loop. Now, by introducing a lattice with the lattice constant A, we automatically introduce an ultraviolet regulator, which in momentum space goes like 1 over A. And how the coupling constant scales as we refine this lattice is given by the beta function. Now, the continuum limit of the theory is approached in the limit where this lattice size becomes infinitely small. But at the same time, we want to keep all physical observables invariant, and this is done by looking at the critical limit where the lattice size goes to zero, the Young-Mills coupling constant goes to zero, while keeping this string tension, in that case, constant. And what people are looking for a second order phase transition in which all correlation lengths in units of this lattice spacing diverge. That means that all physical results computed from this lattice approach are insensitive to the short scale details of this regularization process. And this is what people always have in mind when speaking about the continuum limit and how to approach it in lattice theory. Now, gravity, on the other hand, is fundamentally different, because in that case, in our case, the lattice spacing is itself a complicated functional of the dynamical field, which is the metric. And so the lattice spacing is the integral of an elementary link over the arc length of this curve. And indeed, as GAB, the metric is a dynamical field, we find that in loop quantum gravity, for instance, the physical size of the simplicial building blocks is itself quantized. And so there seems to be a tension. So how should we approach a continuum limit by sending a lattice spacing to infinity once this is itself an operator that has, for instance, a gap? And indeed, what is argued by many people is that we don't have to tune a lattice spacing to a critical value, but rather have to look at the limit where the number of simplicial building blocks goes to infinity. Now, this is a complicated problem because by sending the number of simplicial building blocks to infinity, one has to refine both the bulk and the boundary in an intricate way at the same time. And that is one of the major research directions by Janka, for instance. And then the question is how one recovers something like diff invariance. And what has been argued is that it is only achieved in some in the asymptotical in this n to infinite limit. So what I've done now was to give an introduction and a general motivation of the ideas. Now, in the second part is the what I've actually asked for, so to give an introduction to spin foams and covariant loop quantum gravity. I will then speak about recent developments and come finally to a conclusion. So now I will give an introduction to the mathematical details of loop quantum gravity. Maybe other, well it, so far I've just given an introduction, so. But if there are any questions. What is the general structure of the theory or the overall idea? The idea is to do quantum gravity in finite regions. Now, why finite regions? Well, by introducing a discretization, for instance, we are working at finite n, so we can only cover finite size region in space-time. And that is somehow behind this whole structure. So, but how can we make sense of quantum gravity in finite regions? Well, this goes back to the work of Robert Oeckel and many others, where we assign a Hilbert space to the boundary of our space-time region that we are considering. And this boundary, the state vectors in this boundary Hilbert space are typically complex valued functions of the induced three geometry on this boundary. The amplitudes are then given as a path integral of this of the boundary states integrated against the action of the theory. In here, I'm considering the case of a metric theory where the three geometry is encoded in the intrinsic three metric on the boundary. But in loop quantum gravity, we are working with a connection formalism. Probabilities are given by this amplitudes normalized over an orthonormal basis. And what is important is that this formal expression of the path integral formally solves the Wieler-DeWitt equation. So by making sense out of this, we have a chance to impose the Hamiltonian constraint of general relativity. So how is this Hilbert space of loop quantum gravity actually constructed? As I mentioned already, we are not working in a metric formalism where we are looking at the induced three metric on the boundary. Rather, we are looking at a connection formalism. So where instead of using three metrics, we use orthonormal frames in the spatial slice. Indeed, the fundamental configuration variables are the Ashtekar connection, which is the three-dimensional Levi-Civitar connection on the spatial hypersurface shifted by the extrinsic curvature of this hypersurface. The extrinsic curvature is something like the time derivative of the three metric on this slice. And the canonical momentum of this variable is the electric field, which is the densitized triad. So E is the orthonormal frame, which is one form taking values in the Lie algebra SU2. And by dualizing this, we get a vector valued density, which we can naturally integrate over two-dimensional surfaces in the discretization. Now, the Hilbert space of the theory is constructed from a Schrödinger quantization, where we take complex valued functionals of the connection, but we don't look at arbitrary complex valued functionals of the connection, but we restrict ourselves to those that can be put on a lattice, which are in fact so HL here is the holonomy of this connection, so the parallel transport along a link, and our wave functions of tree geometry are built from these as complex valued functionals of these holonomies. Now, this space comes with a natural inner product, which is inherited from the inner product on the gauge group. And because the gauge group is compact, we can make sense of this inner product so this inner product as lives on a certain graph, but because the gauge group is compact, there's a we can take an inductive limit where these where the labels of these spin network graphs disappear in the continuum. Yes.
Of course.
Yes.
Okay.
Exactly. So all this. This is a canonical approach, as I have presented here on the slides. So one starts from a 3+1 split of the of an appropriate action. In that case, the Holst action, and arrives at this canonical structure where A, the connection, and the electric field are conjugate to each other. This Hilbert space comes with a because we have quantized variables that have a geometric interpretation, namely E is the dualized orthogonal frame. By quantizing this theory, we are naturally getting a theory of quantum geometry. And that happens as follows. So by quantizing this electric field, which is dual to the, which is the momentum conjugate to the connection, we get a flux operator for each surface dual to one of the links in the three-dimensional graph. And this operator can be quantized. In fact, its commutation relations are just the commutation relations of SU2. And by quantizing this operator, what we get is that the area, the physical size of this triangle is quantized. In fact, for an elementary surface, the eigenvalue of area associated to a link, which carries a spin J, is proportional to the Casimir of the SU2 group. And this gives the first hint of quantum geometry, but this goes actually further. What one finds is that at each node of your spin network graph, to each node, you can associate a three-dimensional polygon, but not a classical polygon, but a quantized polygon, where all the areas are quantized. But other geometric properties are fuzzy. The question is then, now this is just a quantum theory on a given 3D slice. What is the question is how to regain the dynamics of general relativity in this formalism. That is, how to write down transition amplitudes or probability amplitudes for physical processes. And one proposal for doing so, which is one of the simplest, but there are of course many different, are the EPRL amplitudes. And the EPRL amplitudes are essentially given by a certain vertex amplitude that we assign to each four-dimensional simplicial building block. So what I've drawn here is a spin foam. So on a 3D slice, we have a spin network function which represents a quantum state of geometry. So the links of these spin networks represent a quanta of area, while the nodes of these spin networks represent quanta of volume. And to define the dynamics of the theory, what one introduces is a spin foam, which is like the evolution of a spin network under time, so to speak. And a spin foam consists of two-dimensional surfaces, one-dimensional edges, zero-dimensional, so point-like vertices, and the amplitudes of the theory are basically certain assignments of weights to each of these building blocks, so amplitudes to faces, vertices, and edges, and one then has to sum over all labels. And the labels for each face are the spins of these one-dimensional edges, while the weights for these one-dimensional edges are the quantization of the not go into this too much. So maybe I skip this. Now the question is, and that's of course the crucial point of this whole business, is how to recover from these discrete amplitudes something like Regge calculus. And what one looks at, or all results, or most results that have been found so far, are in the following limit. So one looks at an expansion where the areas of these elementary triangles or surfaces in the discretization are small to the scale of curvature, so the a macroscopic scale, and at the same time small to the fundamental length scale of the theory. And by doing this expansion, what one can show is that one can recover the Regge action. But this comes with a certain caveat, namely that the which has been pointed out by Valentin and found independently by others, that the deficit, so what one gets in this limit is the Regge action. So from the amplitudes of the theory, one finds that they are peaked on a classical action, which is an action for classical general relativity on a simplicial lattice in terms of edge lengths, which are these what I've denoted by these L's. Yes.
So it's a statement for a triangulation which is somewhat bigger than what it is. So you say this for general triangulation?
Yes.
And so the you assume first, so psi is bound with it.
Yes. Yeah, so psi is...
So you assume that the boundary state is peaked on a triangulation?
Exactly.
Which on the boundary has this curvature scale?
Yes.
And so how do you make sure that, say, then you somehow probably need to assume that actually the curvature scale in the y is small, and how do you make sure of that?
Well, I would say the problem is really this, that what one finds is that the deficit angle, so indeed.
Even ignoring this accidental curvature constraint, which let's ignore that, I think that there's also a question. Assume we would have not these curvature constraints, and we would kind of believe that we get Regge action. Then this is a question indeed how well you find, at some point I will also make this assumption, but is fixing some curvature scale on the boundary, you could be kind of put it, the boundary below the black hole, very far away.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. So
there's a big question, what can you say about the bike? Do we have to assume something about the bike?
Yeah, absolutely. So I agree with this critics. So what one shows here is indeed Subsai is a semi-classical state peaked on a geometry parameterized by certain edge lengths. So each edge in the discretization is peaked on a certain L. And then one says, well, in this limit that corresponds to this expansion, the amplitudes approach the rejection. Now, on the saddle point of the on the saddle point of this amplitudes. Now, of course, this doesn't prove general relativity because but by going from here to here, one has somehow already exhausted all variations. So what one would also have to show is that one is also peaked here that this is not just the rejection, but the rejection evaluated on a solution of the Einstein equations. This is what you're saying.
When you're taking the limit, you're saying gamma times J equal constant, but I think I've forgotten what gamma is.
Excuse me. So in loop quantum gravity, we have an additional free parameter that appears in the definition of the connection, which is the Baveo-Immersive parameter, which gives the relative strength of this connection versus the spin connection. So gamma is a real number, but it enters the spectrum of the geometric observables. If you look here, for instance, the area of an elementary triangle, which is dual to a link, is given by the Planck area times the square root of this Casimir times this gamma. So this Baveo-Immersive parameter enters the spectra of the geometric observables. Now, if we go to this slide by saying gamma j is constant, this simply means that we won't. So this limit means that we keep the area of each triangle fixed while sending the fundamental length scale, so the scale of discreteness, to zero. So the quantum mechanical discreteness is sent to zero, while the discreteness of the lattice that you introduce by introducing discretization of space-time is remains the same, is kept constant. So there are two discretenesses in this theory. One that comes from the lattice regularization by introducing a four-dimensional triangulation or something more general. And the other discretization, the other source of discreteness is the quantum mechanical one that tells us that the geometric observables are quantized. And we want to send 1 to 0, namely in this limit, we send 1 to 0, namely the quantum mechanical discreteness, while keeping the discreteness of the lattice. This is needed because we want to keep an external boundary data fixed. So the external the geometry on the boundary is fixed, and one sends the physical discreteness to zero. Yes, please.
I am confused because, for example, if you model so there would be no gamma, for example, the Dirac train, mm-hmm. how would you take this limit? Because the way you're presenting it, it seems that the whole this limit works because you have these two length parameters, like gamma and the spins. if your theory is only one parameter?
Well, it would be a, why would it be a, well, you can, well, I would say we know that the Barrett train model is not a good model of quantum geometry, and that is one reason why that is so. In fact.
What is the reason why you call gamma or something?
Not only that, but it manifests itself in different aspects.
Yeah. Maybe we can put we know because other people don't know it.
Well, for Barrett train model, you can still take the limit of j to infinity, and you still even get a similar expression. It's just that at the same time, keeping gamma times j fixed to some physical area, something that you're right, you cannot
do. Yeah.
But the j's in the Barrett train model don't have a good interpretation in terms of areas anyway. Well,
yeah, but you get not length vertical, but area vertical. So there could be a mismatch between the shapes of the areas.
Yeah.
So
but
which
it's
is
the same
interpreted
case
as
here.
I mean,
yeah.
I mean,
the same
thing
is this,
that
it's not very clear what
theta
is.
I'm just thinking
that
it's
the point of view that usually don't have
theta
parameter.
Ah, yeah.
But that's what was the limit of expression. Like, then we know that the limit works for one simplex. I don't know how much we can say about several simplices because it's always this limit where we have to send all j's to. Be large and
become
and here sometimes, I mean, I haven't really read the literature, but there's a mixture of claims what we can say about the bike and not. I understood that Hank and Voigt claimed at some point you can say something about the bike without sending the bike G2.
Well, what I would say to this is, for instance, this issue, for instance, I can also see in this purely classical formulation that I have introduced of spin forms, where you have just a classical action on a simplicial complex, which is an action for the EPOL model, and there these very same issues appear in the bulk for an arbitrary discretization. So
can I add about the about the interpretation of gamma? The interpretation of gamma as a prefactor in terms of an area in this approach is very much tied to the canonical theory, where you have spin network functions and where the areas of some two-dimensional surface are proportional to gamma. Now that's very much tied to the boundary Hilbert space. This boundary Hilbert space looks completely different in Barrett-Train model. That's why you don't really have a good area interpretation. Obviously, you can just don't think about boundary Hilbert spaces and just look at the four-dimensional theory, and then the expression for the j's is similar to the area.
Yeah,
but
in the case of the Barrett-Crane model, it's not clear what
but
is the relation to gravity.
It has a completely different interpretation as the one from the boundary. Yeah.
To take the classical limit, keeping the physical areas constant, and sending the Planck length to zero, one just need to send h bar to zero. Doesn't need to ever talk about gamma. So you send what L zero square, whatever its expression is, to zero, and so it's very degenerate. It could be obtained by sending h bar, g, or gamma. What these models answer. So then you distinguish these if you put other fields, which are coupled to G or to H bar in some way, but not to gamma, and then you have more room to play. But for the moment, the important thing is to send L0 to zero and rest.
Yeah, that is right. Yeah.
I've got another question about the Barbeau and the parameter, but maybe that's something that we should postpone to another one. I was always thinking that this was just a constant that you had to fix at one point to get everything to work out. I remember there was some discussion about how you fix it to get the right area law for the black hole and stuff. So, but now you're treating it as a coupling constant that you can send to some limit. So does anything with renormalization happen to it, or?
Well, it is in this theory, it's the only free parameter, unless you couple additional fields, like unless you add a cosmological constant and additional method degrees of freedom. So just for this theory itself, there is not much room for speaking about renormalization of gamma. But of course, that would be a very important thing to do, because then we could indeed go into the direction that you were suggesting, that it could be that one does not have to fix the Bavarian music parameter by these black hole arguments, but rather that it naturally flows to a certain value. And that would be, of course, amazing, but there are very little results on that.
Yes. Just ask a comment about the same thing. If you change the Barberian music parameter, this amplitude changes from acting on a bigger space to acting on a different one. So the whole interpretation of the limit is a bit strange. You have a family of amplitude, but from different people space that somehow converges. And so the interpretation
is weaker. This is not true in the formulation that I've presented here, because the spin networks that one uses in this spin form approach are constructed from SO13 instead of rather SU2. So in the definition of the amplitudes, there's a map which is called Y gamma that sends SU2 amplitudes, SU2 spin networks into SL2C spin networks. And then it makes sense to speak about a limit where gamma is changes. So it's not that there are, so the different Hilbert spaces to different gammas are constructed from the embedding of SU2 Hilbert space into a Hilbert space that carries a representation of SU2 into a Hilbert space that carries a representation of SL2C. And then it, by this embedding, perfectly makes sense to speak about changing lambda by fixing external SU2 spins, because there's an embedding involved by sending SU2 spin networks into SL2C spin networks. And this embedding depends on a free parameter. And in that way, you can make sense of this limit in a precise way.
Yeah, just to answer your question, the point of view that the black hole entropy fixes this parameter was 10, 15 years ago. More recently, there was other papers by Alejandro Perez and collaborators, but so that you can recover the correct leading order. What the music parameter value is, and the music parameter only comes in with the log correction. And then there's the work by Simone Speziale and Dario Benedetti, where they looked at the one loop flow of the music parameters, so showing that it's going to flow as much as the cosmological constant. I don't remember if you've got the fixed point or not, but yeah, it does change. And then there's the work by, ongoing work by Tim. Well, we looked at the randomization of the EPRL or modified EPRL amplitudes, and I think they are working on trying to look at the flow of music parameter material, so it's still going to flow.
Okay.
Okay,
but maybe to reiterate Jose's point, I mean, it's true that we have an SU2 Hilbert space, and gamma does show up just in terms of the Hilbert space. But then it shows up in the spectrum,
right?
So it's a bit more subtle, I think.
What is more subtle?
The map between different gammas. Because here, one says gamma j is a bit constant, kind of. you pick a pick certain subs, you pick certain states inside the liver space where you send J to the liver. And when you send J to infinity, and have this condition that gamma needs to scale to zero. And at the same time, you have the operators on this liver space. And the point is that the indeed
yeah, but you can always rescale the operators such that they don't depend on gamma. By counting everything in terms of.
But you need to rescale such that the J, I mean, it's a more subtle rescaling because the operators in itself, I mean, the spectrum depends on J. So it's kind of a more subtle rescaling.
Yeah, but you can always count area in length of
gamma j.
And then the
it's not really, I mean, depending on which spectrum you have.
So now let me go on to reasoned. I still have more than half an hour, so there is enough to say. So we have been here, and all what has been done here is on a fixed triangulation or on a fixed discretization of space-time, which induces also discretization on the bulk. And beside these first order problems that we have now all discussed, there's the second question, how to define amplitudes that don't depend on this discretization. Like I said in the beginning, in the case of QCD, if we go to the critical value, the details of the discretization disappear. While in here, there is everywhere this discretization of space-time, so the simplicial complex floating around. And the question is how to get rid of this in a systematic way. So how to define a continuum theory that doesn't depend on a simplicial on a fixed simplicial discretization. And what has been proposed are basically two approaches, which come under, and this issue comes under the name of summing versus refining, which are two strategies to tackle this problem. In the case of refining, the idea is to somehow mimic what we did in the what we do in loop quantum gravity on the boundary, on the three slices of space. On the boundary, what we do is to define an inductive limit. So we have Hilbert spaces associated to graphs gamma. So this is a graph, which is a collection of certain links and nodes. And this graph Hilbert space is isomorphic to L2 of SU2 to the number of links divided by the gauge group, which is again SU2 at the nodes. And the detail of this quotient depends on the adjacency relations of this graph. And this is the Hilbert space that we assign to a boundary. So gamma is a graph in the boundary of your Pohr manifold. And now the continuum limit on the boundary, so the full Hilbert space of the theory, is obtained in an inductive limit where we send this graph gamma to an infinitely fine discretization. And how is this done in practice? Well, because the gauge group is compact, we can stack the Hilbert spaces onto each other. So if one graph is a subgraph of another graph, we can show that the corresponding Hilbert spaces are one is contained in the other. And by this relation, we can define a Hilbert space which doesn't depend on the graph, by simply saying for any two states in this big Hilbert space, so psi, phi in H, we can always find a graph gamma such that psi and phi are in H gamma, and then the inner product between psi and phi is just the inner product on gamma. And since the gauge group is compact, in the case of SU2 variables, this limit exists and defines a Hilbert space which is independent of the discretization. Simply because we can map one Hilbert space into the other. And now the idea in the refining case is that the same can happen also in the bulk, that there is a way to refine the amplitudes, that saying the amplitudes on a finer four-dimensional discretization are approximated by the amplitudes on a coarser discretization, and the limit where the discretization goes to infinity, so infinitely small, doesn't depend on the details of the discretization, and these amplitudes exist. This is of course not proven, but that's somehow the idea of this program. Another way of doing is to look at, define a theory which doesn't depend on the discretization is by summing, which means that for a given discretization on the boundary, so we have our four-dimensional manifold M, and on the boundary we use some fixed discretization of the boundary, and then we sum over all four-dimensional discretizations in the bulk that induce this fixed discretization on the boundary. And then by summing over all these amplitudes with certain weights, we get amplitudes that are independent of the details of the discretization.
So in the second line, do you mean the refinement limit of bulk?
Yeah, so the second line is a refinement limit just of the bulk triangulation. Now, then there is the second issue, whether this can be performed independently of a discretization in the boundary. So there are somehow two approaches. One is to keep the triangulation in the boundary fixed and go to an infinitely fine discretization in the bulk. And the other approach is more along the lines what you're doing, that the two things cannot be done.
It's not my emotion of
the
And maybe as a comment here, which I see as a problem, which is a doing principle. So both, I mean, the question is then what do these amplitudes mean? And so I think there's no, for instance, if you take two of such amplitudes that you got by defining the norm vibe or by summing over just the vibe, and now you glue them together, which means that you take these two amplitudes and integrate over the common derivatives and compare that with some other amplitude which you got independently by this definition, I don't think it will get the same result.
by which so what I mean, in the case of summing, that would be automatically satisfied, because in that case you define.
No, you would not sum, and if you after doing, I mean, if it takes.
Because you define your theory by an auxiliary field theory, and if this field theory is unitary.
Yeah, no, I would have to think, because a priori, if you take the bigger thing, well, it depends on what you mean as bigger thing. You would also glue. You would also sum over triangulations which connect with the. You would sum over a different set of triangulations, and I'm not sure. That that's true.
Maybe we leave this for.
I can. But it's. I just mentioned it because it's actually. I see it as a very important issue.
It's not as clear-cut as you make it sound. I mean, imagine that these H are like the external legs of Feynman diagrams. So you could, you know, you could define continuum Feynman diagrams amplitude with fixed number of external legs. You would still have the problem of finding what is the unitary grouping of these amplitudes, but it doesn't mean that there is not you know, a definition of this amplitude. Fix external number of legs.
Yeah, but what I'm
so
saying.
That's a separate problem.
Yeah, no, but it is a separate problem to get them consistent under root. That's what I think. And so, what, you know, it's not that these.
Yeah, the consistency.
Can we easily see the things which you can now?
Yeah. The consistency now is formulated differently. That is there a way, you know, to do these things? That, you know, it's consistent with your prescription.
So, yeah, so it's still an open question, that's what I wanted to say. That's what I wanted
that,
to say.
Yeah.
And so it's not clear whether this is a priori set.
But it's already, yeah, but that's a necessary condition.
Here at this axiomatic level, it's basically the question whether you take them as the amplitudes which define your theory and you never knew, or not, that's really.
But that's not what he's saying.
He didn't say anything, so yeah. That's so.
I mean, the thing is that you can talk about the concept.
What is the status of these amplitudes?
No, but I think what's in discussion here is whether you can discuss the notion of continuum amplitude with finite boundary data, and you can. Now, you know, you don't necessarily have to refine the boundary to talk about continuum amplitude. Now, once you do that, which is what you do, let's say, in particle physics, you still have, you know, a consistency condition, of course. But so you can have the notion of continuum for finite, you know, finite boundaries.
By gluing, you would have to sum over infinitely many particles, not just about, cannot glue just.
That's my point, actually. So what I'm saying is you know, the question then is what do these amplitudes for finite boundary data mean? And the point is, indeed, is not that we cannot really take them for gluing. It is what you're saying, so that you need to put the,
like for the S matrix is also unitary, but you have to sum over the entire. If you split it in two, you would have to sum over the entire Fock space, so
over
infinitely many particles in there.
You sum over all the boundary stuff and take the limit there. No, that's exactly my point.
Yeah, then.
So it's not sufficient to just sum over some.
But in some sense, in the S matrix, you don't ask for the. It's a bit tricky because the S matrix doesn't have asymptotic entity. So you can't really glue it in halves. And because the gluing in half is the unitary operator. So the consistency you apply to S matrix is not the gluing consistency, it's a more subtle type of consistency. But here, yeah, it's a long one.
Let me go more into the details of how these how, for instance, the summing approach is defined. And there, what is very nice is that one defines the amplitudes in terms of an auxiliary field theory. And this auxiliary field theory is not a field theory on space-time anymore, but on the more on just the underlying gauge group. In fact, what one does is to interpret the amplitudes summed over all triangulations as the Feynman amplitudes of an auxiliary field theory that depends on a coupling constant lambda, which determines the interaction. Now, in principle, there could be many interaction terms, in fact, arbitrarily many. And of course, the question is then how this coupling constant would renormalize. The theory, so the group field theory, as I said, is a field theory on, for instance, in four dimensions of on four copies of the gauge group. And what the field operator of the theory represents is an elementary tetrahedron. And what this interaction term determines is how these tetrahedra are glued together so as to form four-dimensional geometries. The Fock space of this theory is constructed from the one-particle Fock space, which is the loop quantum gravity Hilbert space for a single tetrahedron. And the loop quantum gravity Hilbert space that we defined previously can be then seen in this framework as the Fock space over one particle Hilbert space, which is the Hilbert space of a single tetrahedron, plus additional constraints that tell us how these tetrahedra glue together to form three-dimensional geometries. And recent research has been looking at condensate states, which are generated as coherent states from this field operator. And over the Ashtekar-Lewandowski vacuum of the theory. And much research has been done recently to interpret these condensate states as effective wave functions for cosmological models. We won't hear about this, I think, in this conference, yeah?
As you mentioned in the introduction, you can use the refining method in PCD to get back to the continuum path integral and to derive the beta functions. Has anyone ever used the GFT description and showed a similar calculation?
For QCD?
Yeah.
Ah.
So it should be possible, right? No?
No. They are very different.
GFT, it's a propagator, it's a kind of projector. Whereas in QCD, I think you need to put a coupling there, which I'm not sure whether it's equivalent to the mass parameter which preserves them.
This is what
I think it is. It's the truth coupling, isn't it?
Yeah, this is my question whether you can put together.
But there's also a deeper issue is that the GFT do not compute at all the same thing as what you compute by refining. The GFT sums over the topology, all topology of all lattices. So you know, it cannot be equivalent to something which is defined on a fixed topology. These are, I mean, if you sum with a GFT, what you get is definitely not, you can program, it's definitely not the same thing as what you would get by refining. These are completely different entities. For instance, you know, I mean, by refining, you could hope to get a projector. By summing over GFT, you can prove that the scalar product is always strictly positive. So you don't have a kernel, for instance. So this sum of a topology is makes it drastic. So in QCD, if you find a physical problem where it makes sense to sum of all possible topologies, that is.
In some sense, there's a Hilbert expansion, which is a sum over graphs.
Yeah.
It's a sum over graphs in the sense that you don't sum over J equal to zero.
So you could have sum over graphs which are like refining,
and,
but the GFT sum is not
a sum. It's a sum over embedded regular graphs.
Yeah.
So the big difference, usually I see it as summing or not summing over J equal to zero, and it's a bit unclear how this was. Put or not put into the same, but it's of course a very restricted sum, like not something over the policy.
Yeah. So, I mean, yeah. Here you're talking about the GFT way of summing, which is the widest way you can measure.
But, yeah, so the high temperature expansion, which I guess you know, is still in the nearest thing, summing over.
There is still a way to extract physics out of GFT which is not taking into account standard topology. Like I guess what Daniele is doing in this work, they recover results for FQC, which is doesn't know anything about multiple topology.
Well, I guess you have to be more specific.
I don't know how they do it, but
more specific. What I'm saying is it's just a generic feature of GFT.
So what I'm saying is that here there's probably something else happening, right? Because if they get a result that they can relate to FQC, I mean obviously they did not sum over all topology.
I would disagree with that, but we can argue.
Yeah, we can discuss
this particular, because it's such a simplification. They are summing over all possible disconnected manifolds.
It's not very clear what is about the remix in this case, and it's also not very clear how much they have to join what they show.
What I'm saying is just a basic feature. I mean, if we had a way of summing, which would be like refining, you know, and a capture of GFT would be business. Then we'd have a possibility to look at.
But yeah, so in general, this is, as long says, you can prove in various ways to various complicated ways that summing does not give you the same as refining, and that's a simple argument that refining gives you this vector and summing gives not.
Mm-hmm.
And indeed, the main question is if there's a relation in which regime, and how can you maybe not sum over topologies so that maybe you can regain refining, but so far it's very unclear, and we should not put it into one bucket all the time and say it's the same expansion.
No.
So, just to be not too confused.
Yes, there's maybe the hope, yes, that there is a way to extract in some complicated meaning from GFT something physical as the one you expect by defining, but that's, you know, that's a big thing.
Okay, the second or the other approach is to do refining, which is, as I said, to work on a simulation discretization, and then go to the limit where the number of simulation building blocks goes to infinite. And what one wants, of course, is that the amplitudes don't depend on the way this limit is taken, which is extremely difficult to prove. But in that sense, what we would have is the same structure as in the boundary. On the boundary Hilbert space, we can stack the Hilbert spaces. And the Hilbert space for one graph can be mapped into the Hilbert space exactly as a subspace of into the Hilbert space of a larger graph. And the same strategy may apply in the bulk, where the amplitudes don't necessarily on the boundary, this is actually an exact embedding. When the bulk, it would be enough to have an approximation, so that the amplitudes on a finer graph approximate that the amplitudes on a coarser graph approximate those on a finer graph. And one idea to make this explicit is to work with amplitudes that are finite to all orders. In particular, that happens for 3D gravity. In 3D gravity, when we add a cosmological constant, the gauge group gets deformed and becomes something which is called a quantum group, where this deformation parameter depends on the cosmological constant. A quantum group, so SU2Q is like a normal Q, has similar algebraic structures as a group, with the difference that in its representation theory, there exists a maximal spin. And this maximal spin is like an infrared cutoff. So while the Planck scale gives the ultraviolet cutoff, there's now an additional cutoff for very large spins, which is given by the cosmological scale of the theory, so by the square root of lambda. And if one introduces now a cosmological constant in 3D gravity, all these amplitudes for a fixed discretization are finite. And one can therefore the conjecture or the idea is that the same may happen in four dimensions, where one would then replace the amplitudes without a cosmological constant by the corresponding Q-deformed amplitudes. One proposal to do this has been recently put forward by people here at PI, Aldo Riello and Mushin Han, which take the EPRL amplitudes, so the amplitudes without a cosmological constant, and deform them by taking them as the Chern Simons expectation values of the corresponding boundary graph operators. What is nice about this approach is that it uses the original Ashtika variables, so those where the immersive parameter assumes its geometrically natural value, namely gamma, so namely where there is an I here. What has been shown in this approach is so far not very much on the mathematical side, but the conjecture is, and this is indeed satisfied for Euclidean signature, is that the Q-deformed amplitudes, so the amplitudes with a cosmological constant, are finite and give a deformation of the Lorentz group. And what is nice about this approach is that there seems to be a rich mathematical structure, namely a relation to knot theory, Chern Simons theory, maybe string theory. And the result of Aldo, for instance, is that by studying these amplitudes, which are defined as Chern Simons expectation values of spin network functions, one naturally gets constantly curved polyhedra. So this the elementary simplicial building blocks turn into polyhedra in a constantly curved space. And
I have a question. I mean, it's all very nice results there, but I don't see how that helps at all concerning the problem of the continuum. In some sense, it makes everything just more cumbersome.
It makes everything more. This
has nothing to do with, you know, it doesn't necessarily help at all in addressing the problem you were mentioning.
Well, the idea is that it introduces a cutoff on spins in a geometrically natural way, and that by that all amplitudes are finite.
Yeah, but that maybe make the problem more confusing than clarifying.
Because
it makes some people believe
that
then you don't need to
believe. Yeah, that. No, that is of course not. No, you always have to.
But I made comment on a previous slide, which shows a nice feature.
Previous slide.
Yeah, because I suppose what is happening is that you take actually as a boundary state, you assume the FC Bochian size. What we do in spin forms is to assume the F as a boundary state, and then we put the simplicity constraints.
Yeah, and here it would be BF plus a cosmological constant.
We put the simplicity constraints, however, only on the boundary path, which you do here by saying only on the simplest, only on the simplest path, the simplex in this case. So it's an approximation to the cool stuff where you basically impose the simplicity constraints only on this kind of singular structure, which is given by the graph. And indeed, there's a further question is what happens if you take this and consider basically more complicated graphs, and what are the relations between these different amplitudes? If you insert the simplicity constraints on more complicated boundary.
Yeah, but indeed, this is how to read this equation. So for lambda equal to zero, the amplitudes are the integral of the spin network functions on the boundary weighted by the BF action. And where this Y gamma embeds SU2 spin networks into SL2C spin networks. And what is coded in here are is the solution of the simplicity constraints. Now, the idea to add a cosmological constant is just by putting here lambda V veg B, or maybe a star.
So even without lambda, can you evaluate this?
Without lambda? Yeah, without lambda, this is just the spin network evaluated. Here I've written this functional as a functional of the connection, but written as a functional of holonomies. It's just psi gamma A putting all link holonomies to the identity. And so this line can be seen as an exact definition of what is written here.
So technically what you do is simple, is you typically take the amplitude of the spherical region, which is BF. But you put the simplicity constraints on the on the subclass. But you only put it on the subclass, you don't put it everywhere. Mm-hmm. And so the question is, in principle, you want to put it everywhere, at least Isaac Feynman put it also on the bike or also on the boundary and so on.
Yeah, but in the we are working on a discretization, and we have to put the simplicity constraints
on
all
triangles.
Let's say.
If you think really, if you would glue two of these amplitudes, you can again rewrite that as a gluing between two amplitudes. And the point is that you integrate over over boundary, where if you think of it as a continuum, you know, mostly it's BF. Except at this in between graph where you put this implicit constraint.
Yeah, that is
this shows very nicely the necessity of picking the continuum limit, at least we're putting the simplicity constraints when it shows up in many.
Yeah, but no one says that this would be the amplitudes in the continuum. These are just the amplitudes for one simple building block.
Yeah, we can discuss later. Yeah. I will comment later on what is the meaning of this.
So maybe I go right to the conclusion now, because the so now we are in the last part. So what we need are basically new methods, new ways of thinking. Why is that? Well, the continuum limit of spin forms is believed to be the limit of infinitely many simplicial building blocks in both the bulk and probably at the boundary. And why is this so? Well, because the theory has no lattice constant. Indeed, the physical size of the simplicial building blocks, so the elementary objects in our discretization, is itself a quantum observable. Is itself a functional of the dynamical fields. For instance, the area of a surface is the integral of the determinant, the square root of the determinant of the metric tensor on this surface. And these become operators in loop quantum gravity. And therefore, the common lattice QCD intuition may not apply, and we need new tools. And that's the purpose of this conference.
Another question?
I have a question. Just about what you said at the end of it. Is that the way of seeing the simplicity constraints being imposed on the boundary? Could it be changed to be? To say that you are imposing the constraints in the vertices, in the amplitudes, and leave the boundaries as BF. And you were saying that that happened, that the projector in the Y was only in the boundaries. Could you split it and say that it goes to the vertices? Could, were you?
That is the way how the vertex amplitude is constructed.
Mm-hmm.
So it's basically.
Yeah, you implement it in the.
So basically, to get the vertex amplitude, you know, you imagine it's a boundary. I mean, in the final dual path, what you constructed, this bigger amplitude is put in all into one vertex.
Mm-hmm. But so that interpretation is nicer, saying that it's in the vertex than saying that it's in the boundary.
Yeah, but.
Because then you can.
But you would need
so
a.
You can use the BF state. So the boundary Hilbert space would be very simple. And then you would be doing similar to what you do in other field theories, where you have a free theory in the edges and then the difficult stuff on in the vertices. You can think that way.
You can think, but then you would have to work in the system as a four boundary.
No, is it not just a matter of interpretation? You can just
but one disadvantage might be that you have to represent an SF4 Hilbert space, and then you have to put everything into the boundaries, which is anyway, yeah. One question is here indeed, you put here I'm saying to construct the amplitudes. You imagine that you put in simplicity constraints just in this boundary graph, construct the amplitudes. But in fact, at least you are integrating over the SE2 BF Hilbert space.
Good.
So it's still the kind of the same Hilbert space as the SE2 BF. And indeed, the dynamics, in some sense, they are sitting now in the amplitude, so in some sense, in the vertices. And now the question is, do you want to work with the SE2 BF Hilbert space? And the alternative, the only other alternative, I think, would be to work with SE4. I'm not sure what the advantage of that is. It's a big, yeah. I mean, it has all these advantages to look nicer from a covariant perspective and stuff, etc., and write on, and so on.
But I agree with you. In fact, one doing thinking like this, one realizes that one needs additional constraints. You can picture a four simplex like this. It's five tetrahedra glued together at the vertex. And now, normally we think as imposing the simplicity constraints here. So to say sigma alpha beta, which is the B field, equals zero for some normal n at each of these tetrahedra. But if we want to solve the simplicity constraints at the vertices, what we need is some parallel transport that tells us how to go into the center of the tetrahedron. And by doing this, one realizes that these normals that appear in the definition of the simplicity constraints, which are attached to each of these tetrahedra, are in fact not independent. But if we weight them, if we multiply them by the volume of each tetrahedron, there must be something like a closure constraint satisfied that tells us that these normals, weighted by the volume, is zero. And that may be an additional constraint that sits at these vertices that we may want to impose as well. And this you realize immediately by going from the boundary, as you were saying, to the vertex itself, and impose the constraints there.
So where is this constraint coming from?
Well, it's just the closure constraint.
The closure constraint
for the simplicity.
For the four-dimensional.
For the four-dimensional.
Yeah.
And why is that
secondary simplicity?
The volume simplicity constraint.
Yeah, no, but it had a version which came from a simplex, which was something like
closure. No, the secondary simplicity constraints impose the vanishing of torsion, and this has...
Yeah, it looks like there's a normal, but the parallel transport is normal, so there's something.
Yeah, maybe we can...
I remember something of it around.
Yeah, you can interpret it as a secondary constraint because it's something in space-time, and you impose it. If you impose it, it means that the simplicity constraint will get
in this sense,
it is a secondary
constraint.
Yeah, it doesn't exist all of it. It's only a subset of all the secondary constraints.
Maybe.
Why is that?
But it's not in the components, right? All of it will impose vanishing of quotient.
No, but now you're thinking of the quadratic simplicity.
Yeah, I should have figured it out. So the question is if these constraints are sufficient to guarantee propagation of the primary simplicity constraint.
Yes.
In this sense, you could say they are all the constraints. If you would just look at this, I mean, if you would be in complete discrete formulation, you would just say these are the primary simplicity constraints, and the secondary simplicity constraints are all the constraints which are necessary to ensure that the primary simplicity constraints are propagated to the next time. Mm-hmm.
But at that level, there's no notion of propagation. So it's
there
just
is one which Etterer used, which is that four tetrahedra are propagated.
And then you're saying that whatever splitting you have of your four
simplex, yeah, yeah.
1 to 4, 2 to 3, whatever. And you impose this constraint in the beginning from the first initial tetrahedra, you impose that, you will get the simplistic constraint from the final tetrahedra.
Yeah, in that sense, there cannot be any more constraints because this imposes already the geometricity of the configurations so that all tetrahedra are glued together without any mismatch.
There's always this degeneracy thing. Okay. Maybe let's continue at the coffee break and let's thank Wolfgang from the